Hey, everybody, it's John Horn. I am not in Pasadena. I'm here with a couple Frame colleagues in Park City, Utah. We're here to cover the Sundance Film Festival. We just arrived today, and we already did our first interview. It's with the two directors of a documentary called Crip Camp. It is about a camp in the 1970s for kids with disabilities. And years later, a lot of those campers go on as adults to become leaders in the disability rights movement. We have an interview with the two directors that will be on Friday's edition of The Frame. Here's Thursday's with our guest host, Stephen Cuevas.
From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. We'll hear from John in just a minute about what he's checking out at the Sundance Film Festival. And there's a movie at Sundance that's largely inspired by people who worked for disgraced movie mogul Harvey Weinstein. Kitty Green wrote and directed The Assistant.
What I wanted to do with this film is give people kind of an emotional experience, like be able to get them to understand kind of the gravity of the situation that some of these young women were in and just how unfair and brutal this system was.
And Jonathan Pryce on the challenge of playing His Holiness in The Two Popes. It's The Frame. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn, but he's actually sitting right here beside me, because by the time you hear this, he'll be at the Sundance Film Festival. John, thanks for taking time before you pack your bags.
My pleasure. I love the fact that I'm here, but I'm not here.
John, there are dozens of feature films screening at Sundance, of course. Tell me about some of this year's most anticipated entries.
I'm going to lean toward documentaries. If you look at the movies that are nominated for the Documentary Feature Academy Award this year, three of them premiered at Sundance a year ago: American Factory, Honeyland, and Edge of Democracy. And if you look at the very first night at the Sundance Film Festival, there are new documentaries from some producers you might have heard of, Barack and Michelle Obama. They've got a documentary called Crip Camp, which is about the disability rights movement. There's another documentary about Taylor Swift and about why she is becoming a little bit more political. And that's just in one theater in one night.
Well, one of the documentaries premiering at Sundance that I wanted to ask you about, it's one that's drawing a lot of controversy, and that's the Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering documentary, On the Record. It focuses on the sexual assault allegations against hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. The film was being executive co-produced by Oprah Winfrey, set to be released on Apple TV. Then Winfrey suddenly withdrew support, and some say it was under pressure from Russell Simmons. She denies this and says it's because of questions arising from one of the alleged victims. What's to become of this documentary, On the Record?
Well, it is going to show at the festival. I mean, I think there was a question of whether or not Sundance was going to pull it. The fact that Oprah Winfrey withdrew her support, that Apple TV hit pause on the documentary, is very unusual. And Kirby and Amy have said, listen, we think we've made a really good film. We don't understand what they are complaining about. All of the edits and suggestions up until the time the picture was locked were minor little things. It does feel like Russell Simmons complained to Oprah about the documentary. It's unclear if Oprah thought it was unfair or that it featured one woman's story over others. The movie's going to show, but for a film to go to this festival with this much uncertainty is highly unusual.
Yeah, not to get too far afield on this, but I wonder if Oprah pulling away from this project could somehow damage her own brand in this era of Me Too.
Well, I think she has said that she believes the women who are accusing Russell Simmons of sexual assault and harassment. So I don't think she's saying I am not believing them anymore. I think she has, to her mind, legitimate questions about the documentary. But yeah, it is important that she is on board or not on board, because her producing does suggest that there is a level of quality and credibility to it. And the fact that she's leaving it does ultimately damage, I think, the standing of the film.
Another film I wanted to ask you about was this four-part documentary on Hillary Clinton. It'll be available on Hulu. She will also be attending Sundance for the first time to do promotion for this film. What do you know about it, and, you know, any buzz around it?
I guess I know a fair amount about it. I'm going to be doing a Q&A with Hillary Clinton at the festival. It is a four-part series that has some behind-the-scenes footage of her running against Donald Trump. But it's really about her political career and about how things stand today. So Warts and all, Hillary is a participant in this documentary. And as you said, she'll be at the festival and she'll be talking with me. She says a lot in the documentary. I hope she says even more when we sit down to have a conversation.
There's one other film I wanted to ask you about. And that's a little film called Feels Good, Man. And it's an indie production looking at the rise of this comic called Pepe the Frog that was actually created by a L.A.-based cartoonist. And it sort of became an emblem for the alt-right, who took this image and kind of started using it for anti-Semitic memes, racist memes, all kinds of really nasty stuff. What do you know about the film, and are you going to see it?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to see it. The artist is named Matt Fury,
right.
And it's about how something becomes an icon for hate and how the artist behind that icon tries to reclaim it. And I think if you look more broadly at a lot of the documentaries that are playing at the festival, a lot of them are about what's going on in the world right now. There's a new documentary about the kids who survived the Parkland shooting, about what they're doing to fight against gun violence.
Us Kids, I think that one's called.
There's another documentary called Whirlybird. It's about the helicopter news pilot Zoe Turr and about what her work says about the tabloidization of news and the OJ trial. Boys State is another documentary about 17-year-old boys, 1,000 of them from Texas, who join up to build a representative government from the ground up. So wherever you look, especially in documentaries, there are a lot of films about the current state of the country and what we might do to fix it.
And what are some of the feature films that you're looking forward to checking out?
I know that things that are kind of at the top of our Sundance card include Downhill. This is a remake of the movie Force Majeure, a foreign language movie from a couple years ago. It stars Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Will Ferrell. It's made by Nat Faxon and Jim Rash, who did a movie called Way, Way Back not that long ago. Viggo Mortensen, who is one of my favorite actors, has written, directed, stars in a movie called Falling that I think is partially in Spanish, so there's nothing Viggo can't do. There's an Anthony Hopkins movie based on a play called The Father. There's a movie about Gloria Steinem in many different iterations, directed by Julie Taymor. You might know her from The Lion King. You know, and the other thing that we should talk about, there are a number of movies that are going to Sundance that are looking for distribution. And one of the things that a lot of people forget is that Sundance is not only a film festival, it's a film market. And it'll be really interesting to see, given how poorly some of the movies from last year's festival did at the box office, if the checkbooks will be open as much as they were a year ago.
How is Sundance doing this year when it comes to representation of films made by women, by people of color, by LGBTQ filmmakers?
A lot better than almost every other festival. There are two categories of competition in Sundance, dramatic competition and documentary competition. And Sundance says that 47%, nearly half of the directors in the dramatic competition are women, 52% are people of color, and 5% identify as LGBTQ. If you look at documentaries, 45% of the directors are women, 23% are people of color, and 23% define as LGBTQ. A lot better than most festivals.
That's The Frame host John Horn with me talking about the Sundance Film Festival. By the time you hear this, it'll be there. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Stephen.
Up next on The Frame, Harvey Weinstein once ruled Sundance. Now there's a movie premiering there inspired by his predatory behavior. The rape and sexual assault trial of Harvey Weinstein is underway in New York. A new movie called The Assistant is largely inspired by stories of working for the disgraced movie mogul. It's screening at the Sundance Film Festival and soon in theaters. The Assistant stars Julia Garner as a lowly assistant to a Weinstein-type tyrant who's got his entire staff doing his bidding. Australian filmmaker Kitty Green based the script on interviews she conducted with people who work in the movie industry. Here's John Horn's conversation with Green.
When you were talking to people in the business about their takes on what was going on, how did those conversations shape the story you were telling?
I mean, I spoke to a lot of people. I spoke to people who had worked in at different film companies. I started with Weinstein Company and Miramax, and I broadened out to people that worked at agencies and who worked, you know, at broadcast, like at networks. And I think the weird thing for me was that everyone had the similar stories. Like, the same stories were coming up again and again, and these patterns were emerging. I also spoke to people in London and Australia. And so that, to me, was really fascinating, that everyone kind of felt similarly about, like, things that they'd felt were they were uncomfortable about, how those concerns were kind of ignored or rejected by HR departments and other kind of people higher up in the companies they worked for. And so, yeah, that was really fascinating. And as soon as those patterns emerged, I started writing these stories down because I realized, oh, gosh, it's so familiar.
Hey, there's a girl waiting at reception. She says that she's supposed to start here today.
Working here with us? Where's she from?
Where's she from?
Idaho.
Idaho?
Idaho? Is that the one you met in Sun Valley? Oh, her. She's been here before. A few times. Send her in.
Often people don't know the full extent of what they're involved in. They're getting bits and pieces and not... They're kind of getting the dots, but they're unable to join them. And I think if there is a culture of silence, you don't really ever discover the full extent of what's going on behind closed doors because you're almost discouraged from chatting to your colleagues about certain questions or certain concerns you may have. So yeah, all of that, I mean, that became kind of the structure of the film is about one girl and her experience and how what she knows and what she doesn't know and what she's trying to piece together.
So were those interviews ever going to be a documentary, or were they always going to be kind of material to shape your screenplay?
No, it was never going to be like, I would have filmed them if I thought they were going to be used in a documentary. It was more kind of, I was sort of approached it with, listen, this will be actors recreating things on stage. So that was sort of the way I dived into it. But it did take shape as it evolved as it went.
One of the things that is central to the conceit of the film is that we know the assistant, we know other staff people, but we don't know exactly who it is they're working for. That person is kept off camera and mysterious. Why did you make that decision?
Firstly, bad men have had enough screen time, in my opinion. Secondly, I was interested in the larger systems. I wasn't interested in him necessarily. We know, we've read enough in the media. We know what's going on behind that closed door. And what I was interested in more was the culture and the environment surrounding that.
One of the things that I was really struck by is the atmosphere of the office. There's this timelessness. You don't know if it's morning, if it's night. There's all the minutia of what an assistant does, you know, like plane reservations, like, you know, is the chef taken care of? Is the driver ready? That feels so authentic that it feels like you are really in that office. How did you go about making sure that you were portraying what that job looks like outside of what these people actually are wrestling with on a personal level?
My background is in documentary, and so I'm always interested in the details. More so, like that, to me, was really important that in Jane, the lead character's day and her the tasks she does and her routine was very real and authentic. And so, I mean, I worked with a big team, and we just was really kind of focused on making sure that felt accurate and right. And I guess that was the process. That was the way we went about it. I mean, I think when you're dealing with a film that's about people, a person who is unwittingly complicit in something, you need to look at time and her day and her to figure out just, well, how much of her job was just getting coffee and photocopying, and how much it was of it was doing something that perhaps she was uncomfortable with, or you know, that can be seen as complicit in some way.
You also make a decision not to have the lead character physically attacked in any way. Why'd you choose that?
She's a victim of a toxic work environment and a gendered work environment. But to me, it was important to kind of talk about, I didn't want it to just be the story of the girl who was assaulted. I feel like there is to fix this problem which we've got, I think we need to examine sort of all facets of it. And I think the idea of somebody who is just trying to get ahead at work and being prevented by kind of these forces is an important story to be told.
We're talking with Kitty Green about her film, The Assistant. There's a moment in the film where Jane, who's played by Julia Garner, goes to the HR department, and the HR person is played by Matthew McFadyen.
Welcome. Have a seat. Whatever's going on, you can tell me. That's what I'm here for.
It is a terrifying scene because the more she talks, the less interested he is in what it is that she is saying.
What can we do?
Do about what?
Tell us about that scene and why you needed to include it in the film.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we... I guess I made this film so we can kind of examine the system that we've created, that we're all a part of, that was enabled, you know, that has contributed to the fact that women have been hurt and sidelined for so long. So I wanted to examine the system as a whole, and a big part of that system is the HR teams, who often are there to protect the company. They're there to, that's their job, is to make sure the company's protected and not the employees. So that scene was really important to me, that both he, Matthew's character, and Julia's character had a kind of conflicting points of view. And yeah, putting that together was really important. And just making sure that she, I mean, she went into that scene. I mean, often people go into these HR departments and to make a complaint and come out just so rattled and so confused. And it's almost like he rips apart her complaint immediately in front of her and dismisses her. And I just wanted to make sure that felt, real and authentic.
No, he says that she's jealous of a new assistant. He says, you don't think a grown woman can make her own choices? Do you want to keep working here? I mean, he is threatening her. He's belittling her. And he is basically saying, you can make a choice. You can have a career in this business or you can walk out right now.
Yeah, you're making it sound a lot more dramatic. That's good.
It's a great scene. I think it's a fantastic scene.
I mean, it's incredible. I really just wanted to make sure. I mean, he has basically, I didn't want him to be too evil, over the top evil, to the point where, you know, he's just swearing at her. I kind of really wanted to make sure his answers were clear and concise and made sense. And they do. I mean, she is rattled by this idea that she's questioning another woman's kind of reasons for being there. And is she jealous? And is she, I wanted to really play with all that. And so it's great that it comes across. Those two, by the way, did such an amazing job with that scene. They're so good. They're such great actors, and they did it again and again. It's 12 pages and they knew it all and just did it over and over. And it was fabulous every time.
I have to say, this movie has really stayed with me. I think what you created is such a realistic depiction of what it feels like to be in that workplace. And I'm wondering what kind of conversations you hope the film sparks about workplace gender dynamics, about the Me Too movement.
Well, I mean, firstly, I want people to come away thinking about their own role and their own behavior, because I feel like it isn't just about the misconduct. It's also about kind of the culture in these work environments and how we can make our workplaces more safe and fair and equitable for everybody. So I think if those conversations can be had, and I know it's difficult to kind of analyze our own environments and our own complicity, but I think we are all a part of this system. And so in order for it to change, we really need to dissect it completely and strip it apart and rebuild it and get more women in power. That would be ideal.
What can a narrative film do, especially on a subject like this, that a documentary couldn't?
We know the facts. Like, we've read, there's been a lot of coverage in the press. We know what's happens in those rooms. We know what was going on. What I wanted to do with this film is give people kind of an emotional experience, like be able to get them to understand kind of the gravity of the situation that some of these young women were in and just how unfair and brutal this system was for so many people. So, I mean, for me, that's something that I think a narrative film can do, is really take you on a journey emotionally with a character and really get you to identify with somebody who often in your life, I mean, a lot of people have assistants and ignore them. They seem invisible. And I wanted to make sure she was centered in this narrative and that people could just look at this whole experience, this whole event, from somebody's point of view that's different from their own.
It's probably not lost on you. You're going to show this film at the Sundance Film Festival, where allegedly some sexual assaults by Harvey Weinstein were committed. What is it showing in Park City mean to you about what has happened there in the past?
People ask me, like, should I be showing it here and there? And I think this is a film that should be seen by as many people as possible. And these are conversations that need to be had everywhere. And the more we can have these conversations, the better, kind of, hopefully, the system will get. So I'm all for screening it at Sundance and making sure people see it and talk about, well, how can we change things and how can we improve things moving forward?
Kitty Green is the writer and director of The Assistant. Kitty, thanks so much for coming back on The Frame.
Thank you for having me.
The Assistant debuts at the Sundance Film Festival and then opens in theaters on January 30th. Up next on The Frame, does Jonathan Pryce have a prayer at an Academy Award for his portrayal of Pope Francis? The Netflix movie The Two Popes stars Jonathan Pryce and Anthony Hopkins. It tells an imagined story of when Pope Benedict, played by Hopkins, wants to step down and tries to convince Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio to take over. Bergoglio would go on to become Pope Francis. In the film, he's portrayed by Jonathan Pryce, whose performance earned him an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor. John Horn spoke with Price at the Telluride Film Festival.
When I was first asked to play Pope Francis, I thought, oh no, this isn't a good idea. Because the day he'd become Pope, the internet was full of images of me next to him.
Fratelli, sorelle.
Buonasera, sisters. Good evening.
And the likeness was being brought out into the public eye. And even one of my sons sent me a text saying, Dad, are you the Pope? So it seemed a bit easy to actually come to play him. It seemed a bit of, am I just being employed because I look a bit like him? But it is this head of the church is someone that politically and socially I can fully embrace and endorse. I think the end, the final images sum up what the film is about. It's about the kind of progressive attitude that Francis had, when he went into the Vatican, because he's met a lot of opposition there for his reforms. But what he ultimately represents, I think, it's inspirational that you should think not of yourself, but you should think about breaking down the walls, the barriers. And, well, in this instance, it's about welcoming refugees and opening your arms and embracing that situation.
I want to ask you about working with Anthony Hopkins, because there are moments that feel as if they could be theater.
Why do the presidents of America and Russia and China come to you? Because, unlike them, your authority comes from the fact that you will suffer and die in the job. A martyr to justice and truth. For this, all people come. Forgive me, but...
But?
Christ did not come down from the cross.
Ah, God always grants you the right words.
Oh, no, no. A pope must go on forever, be the personification of the crucified Christ. If you do this, you will damage the papacy forever.
Well, what damage will I do if I remain?
When Francis first approaches Benedict, he comes there to ostensibly to resign. He wants to leave the church. And he is fully respectful of whatever he thinks of Benedict. He is the Pope. And there's a sense of, or when he walks into the Sistine Chapel, and there's something about the presence of Benedict. And I had that as an actor, because, you know, as a young actor, I've followed Anthony Hopkins' career. And there was that sense of awe and wonder about this particular man, this fellow Welshman. And then the other side of it is that Tony and I just got on really, really well. And we made each other laugh. There was intense rivalry between the two of us, because the call sheet, which lists the actors' names and the order of seniority on the cast, and I was number one, and number two was Tony Hopkins, and he was constantly ribbing me for being number one. He kept moving the number on my trailer to his, and had huge signs made for his trailer, trying to boost his importance. And we email each other quite often, and he still emails me, good morning, number one, from sir number two, just let me know.
We're talking with Jonathan Price about his movie, The Two Popes. Fernando seems very willing to let you as actors be actors. He's very patient with the camera, not doing anything too fancy, although the camera's very present. It's very close to you as actors.
Cesar, the cameraman, it was just wonderful to watch Cesar work. You've got static cameras in most of the scenes, and in the middle, Cesar is a handheld, and you can see that the camera's always moving. And you just knew whatever you did, Cesar was going to capture it. Any little look, any whatever, he was there. You know, it's about two men talking, but the energy and the movement in those duologues, it's wonderful. And that's why, you know, a lot of the audience will go in thinking, oh, we're going to see a rather dry conversation between two popes. And we undercut those expectations all the time with the film. Even the opening sequence where he's on the phone trying to book a ticket.
Good morning and welcome to the SkyTour sales desk.
Good morning. I am looking for a flight from Rome to Lampedusa.
Yes?
I know I can book it on the internet, but, you know, I've only just moved here.
Name?
Bergoglio, Jorge Bergoglio.
Like the Pope?
Oh, well yes. In fact...
Postcode?
I'm not sure. Vatican City.
Very funny.
And the agent hangs up on him when he says his return address is the Vatican. She thinks it's a prank.
And that is the opening image, and the laughter whams out from the audience. And it's great because we let them know it's okay to laugh.
Jonathan, great to see you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
That was John Horn with Jonathan Pryce. He's got a lead actor Oscar nomination for The Two Popes, which is available on Netflix. And that's all for today. But remember, there's another way to keep up with us by signing up for our weekly email at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center. Dividend, 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 dividend